Welcome to Discover Your Talent, Do What You Love, number 217. I'm creator and host, Don Hutchison. Every day, I interview someone from around the world who has discovered his talents to do work he loves to create a life of success, satisfaction, and freedom. Today, I'm delighted to bring you our featured guest, Gurumer Khalsa. Welcome, Gurumer.
Thank you.
Gurumer, are you using your talents doing work that you love?
Yes, I am.
All righty. We want to hear the whole story. Gurumer means compassionate teacher. He has taught Kundalini yoga and trained teachers for 35 years. He's a professional life coach and author of Senses of the Soul, a book and complete system of training in emotional self-therapy for personal strength, healing, and inner guidance. He offers private and group coaching, live workshops, and web courses at senseofthesoul.com. He lives in Los Angeles with his wife and two children. Gurumer, that's a pithy summary of your career. Tell us what you're up to now that has you engaged.
Well, Don, right now I'm sitting in my beautiful home office in the west side of Los Angeles, and it's a real chilly 61 degrees outside. Sun is shining. It's beautiful. And I spend my days talking to people as a life coach, helping them bring more happiness into their lives. My book, Senses of the Soul, is my mission now. And so I get to spend, whether it's weekend workshops or online trainings, helping people increase their emotional skills and their emotional well-being. And it's just what I've been waiting all my life to do. And there's no difference between work and play for me now. It's just, it's all
beautiful. As you well know, everyone's life journey is composed of a series of turning points, some call them passages. And at these important times, we're faced with obstacles, opportunities, and choices that determine the next period of our lives, the next several years of our lives. Take us back as far back in your story, Gurumer, as you want to, and share the more poignant and impactful turning points.
Don, I can remember being somewhere around 8 years old, eight to 10 maybe, and feeling both a darkness in me, you know, kind of like my troubles at 8 years old.
Yes.
But also, I remember like seeing some Reader's Digest article about, you know, some way to improve yourself or something. And as early as I can remember, I was in self-inquiry and interested in methods that would help me be happier. I mean, it's really kind of phenomenal to think about an eight-year-old thinking that way.
It's very unusual.
Yeah. Grew up in Atlanta and had a normal, you know, normal mainstream upbringing. But my parents were pretty progressive, pretty open. And they didn't really say, hey, you're going to be a lawyer, a doctor. They did encourage me to figure out what was important for me. And I think that was pretty huge. Everybody's going to college, and I delayed college and that's what everybody else was doing. That's sort of what I was expected to do, but my parents were okay with me. And I think part of it was I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. Nothing really called to me strongly. But so I moved into North Georgia and lived on a small family farm, really a lifestyle not too different from people that might have lived hundreds of years ago. And it was just for me, it was nature and simplicity and just honest work. And I think, you know, spirituality came to play a big part in my life. And I think nature was my first way of figuring myself out and pursuing my own happiness. So I would
say, it makes sense. How did that evolve, though? I mean, did you have friends up there, a family you knew, or how did that?
No, it was just I was, you know, somewhere between rebellious and curious.
Okay.
I just hitchhiked out of town. You know, back then you could, and I just went exploring. I took my little tent and I moved into some land in the country where, you know, there were little small family farms. And basically, it comes down to I just squatted on some land, and a guy came and said, "Hey, what are you doing on my land?" And I said, "Oh, I don't know. I just want to learn about farming, and he said, "Well, come live with me." So I lived with an old elder couple and farmed, just lived a simple farming life. This is out after growing up in the city, and so I'd say that was the first act of sort of both courage or rebellion, and to do what I wanted to do. And I had just a splendid time, and I had been raised without any religion or spirituality, and these guys were religious, and I started studying, you know, that religion, which was Christianity, and mm-hmm. Anyway, so that was a pretty big turning point, I'd say, to delay college and follow my heart there. Still didn't know what I wanted to do.
Well, let me ask you this. This is still it's quite a fascinating story. So you squat on this guy's land, and you're a nice guy, so you weren't doing anything untoward. And he thought he felt good energy about you. But it's pretty amazing that he and his wife took you in.
Well, that was, you know, it was in stages. They said, "Well, you got anything to eat?" And I said, "Well, you know, I'm kind of foraging off the land or whatever." I think the first thing they did, they were just very kind. And they said, "Well, you know, would you like to have supper with us?" And so amazing vegetables and whatever they were serving. And I think they actually said, "Well, why don't you not sleep in the woods and sleep on our couch tonight?" And so the next day, I just naturally wanted to help these old folks with some chores or such. And, you know, I think there's an exchange there, and I enjoyed working physically. And then over the next few weeks or so, it sort of evolved, and I worked there, and they fed me, and it was, that's how it came about.
How long did you stay there?
Approximately 3 years. I started realizing that the intellectual side of me wasn't getting fed, and so I decided to go on to college. And so maybe I was there 2.5 solid years, and then I went to University of Georgia, which wasn't too far away, and commuted back and forth on the weekends and that kind of thing. So, you know, my part-time there extended into, you know, 4 or 5 years, but it was 2.5 years. And there, some of the best years of my life, just, you know, there was no career benefit or income, you know, visible from that. But it was just, it really did shape me in a lot of ways.
Yes, yes. Just fascinating. Did you stay in touch with them as you grew up?
I did. I've still got a picture of this gentleman right here on my desk. And he was like a really strong father figure for me. And, you know, good values, hard worker, just a good person, you know, and that was a big influence. So yes, I've stayed in some touch.
What happened next?
Well, I went on to school and still didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I was interested in science. So I was in physics. I ended up getting a scholarship to a very prestigious university and was doing some work study research in physics. And then, I mean, it looked like I had it all. I could have really had a full scholarship, could have had a great, great career. And I just started feeling empty. I started feeling unhappy. So that was a big struggle. That was hard. I actually took a year sabbatical and went again into nature, went hitchhiking, backpacking up into British Columbia and Alaska. And again, it was, I challenged myself. I lived out in the woods with, you know, just living off the land, and it was pretty adventurous again, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. But about that time, I did start learning Eastern forms of meditation.
How old were you then, Guru Mehr?
20, 21-ish. I started more back to this thing at 8 years old of looking for ways to, you know, find peace and happiness within myself. Mm-hmm. I started Zen Buddhism and then the philosophies of yoga. So I was sort of just like this almost modern day wandering ascetic, you know, but living very happily in the woods and studying these sometimes ancient teachings and learning to meditate. And this was back in, you know, what is this? It's late, mid to late 70s. So it wasn't like yoga was a thing. And so somehow I spent this time, I guess, looking inside, you might say. I was enjoying my life, but feeling this struggle of who am I? What do I want to do?
Yes.
So I thought I'd go to India and find a yoga teacher. There weren't yoga studios and yoga classes at that time. And I was into sort of the real spiritual teacher thing. And so I found a teacher here in America, a guy who'd come from India. And so that was a pretty big turning point. I committed for a year to live in an ashram and do the full yogic way of life, waking up at 3 a.m, 2.5 hours of meditation, you know, living communally and having my main, whatever my job was, which at the time was then just construction, being a contractor, but having my real study being spirituality, I guess I would call it, and through the form of yoga. So that was a big turning point to really, and over that period of year of experimentation, as a former physicist, I really said to myself, you know, I've never been disciplined. I've never stuck to anything. I've never known what I wanted to do. But this calls to me. This really calls to me. So I'm going to spend a year. I'm going to do an experiment and completely, you know, submit to this lifestyle for a year and see what happens.
Wow, beautiful.
And that was a really a year of deep personal study and hard practice. And by the end of the year, I said, so far, so good. I'm going to commit to living this yogic lifestyle for my whole life and see what happens. Because again, I didn't trust myself to stick to something that I knew I wanted. And so that was a big, big turning point.
Yes.
So my main life's work at that point was this study of yoga. And I taught yoga classes and I started teaching other people. And I always considered it, it was not career-based. You didn't make any money that way. But as I see now, that was a big part of my training is becoming a teacher. But on the career side, I was just doing I had some sales and marketing jobs and different things that were, you know, I learned and I was satisfied and I got paid. But there was this haunting, like, this is not what I'm supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. And the excitement of a new job or the challenge or fear of it would wear off. And then I'd be going like, this just isn't it. And I was always a pretty happy, energetic person, but there was this, you know, just this emptiness inside, like, this isn't this isn't me, you know?
Yes, yes.
So there was this urge to align. I didn't want to be a yoga teacher. I didn't think that was very, very, very status worthy, and it certainly didn't pay that well. So it seems obvious, and now I would call myself a yoga teacher, but it's still not really where I make my income.
Right.
About that time, life coaching was invented.
Okay, good. And where are we now? Forgive me for interrupting. Where are we now? What?
We're now in about, I must be in my 30s. No, I must be 45 by now. Yeah.
Okay.
So Thomas Leonard, one of the founders of
Coach University.
Profession. Yeah.
Yes, yes.
He came to town and he basically said, here's the thing where you don't have to know everything. You just have to have the intention to help somebody. You let them figure it out. And to me, this was a very advanced sort of concept that rather than a hierarchical go to an expert and they fix you, you get in there as a fellow human being and help somebody figure their thing out. So I signed up that night with Thomas Leonard's program and became a life coach. And that, of course, was on the side and I was doing a marketing So that was a big decision, and I knew in my heart, just like I knew yoga was my thing, I knew this was my thing instantly. And so I spent some time training and started having clients and then really started my coaching practice on the side while I still had this full-time job. And like I say, I've always been energetic, so I was able to do all of that. And then there was a night where I sat down with my wife and I said, I guess we had just one child then. The second one hadn't come along. And I said, I'm in pain. I got to quit this day job and I've got to do this coaching. This is my calling. I got to do it. And she said, well, not unless you make the same amount of money, because this is what we got to do. So she was basically saying, no, you can't. You got to be responsible. And I remember, Don, and I don't mind sharing it. I wept. I said, you don't understand, dear. This is me. This is my calling. I have to do this. And she said, well, here's the amount of money you're bringing in now. You may not drop below that, you know, because that's what our family needs.
Yes.
And when you can produce that income, you can do that. And that was, you know, that was a really great challenge in the end. I thought I wanted to quit tomorrow and start. It really delayed my transition for about a year as I built my practice and got my skills good and raised my part-time income until I could step off. And, you know, it's interesting because that challenge really served me, the fact that I had to make my money if I wanted to follow my heart, because I had other people that I knew, friends that were also training to be coaches, some of whom who were supported by their spouse and didn't need the income. Mm-hmm. And most of them never really made a business of it. But if I wanted to do it, I had to. That was my story. So I did.
Wasn't that a blessing that your wife could set those strong boundaries and had such conviction, as well as having faith in you? She had all that, right?
The faith, I'm not as sure. About,
I was trying to be generous.
But the boundary was clear, and that's all I needed, you know. So, and God bless me for being the kind of partner that agreed to that. And yes. And it was hard for me to put that off for a year. But the day I even worked with my company to go part time, so I went half time with them as I. Because my coaching practice was getting a little busy. So the day I stepped off from the day I quit my job, I was equaling that income in my coaching practice. And statistics used to be only 1 in 10 coaches that wants to make a living doing coaching actually achieves that. So it may have changed now. I don't know. So I was fortunate to be that. And so a couple more quick transitions so that was it. So I spent a good dozen years, really what I call my clinical study, like really, you know, as a coach, people let you inside their head and their hearts. And, you know, I found that although we all look fine walking around, you know, we dress nice and we smile and thank God we're social, but there's a lot of pain and darkness inside of people, yes. Even that look very successful or, so that really interested me. And what I found was a common thread was how it wasn't just what people had or what their life looked like. It was how they felt about their life, mm-hmm. You know, like feelings. And so I stumbled upon emotions as a key to health, healing, success, fulfillment. I mean, we'll talk more about it. But so another key turning point was following this lead that I had, that emotions were this key element. And you know, you're starting to hear a lot about emotions. There was a movie from Disney, and there's articles almost every day. But, you know, a dozen years ago, emotions were still sort of reviled as this, you know, evil weakness that we all have.
And, right.
So I'd say then another turning point that gets me very close to where I am today was to follow that, even though it wasn't something people talked about or seemed important. And that was like, no, it was something important to me. And yeah, so I began to see that it wasn't just what's on the outside that really affected our quality of life. It was our thoughts, our feelings about ourselves and things. And so this interested me a lot. I always feel like a detective or a scientist when I'm helping people figure out what's causing their, you know, their malaise or whatever their
yes.
problem is.
And
again, it wasn't a popular or well-known sort of topic. Most of psychology at that point was still looking at, you know, disaffection and, you know, dysfunction.
Correct.
And so using my background in as a meditation coach, as a yoga teacher, I found that I could get people to figure out their problems for themselves and much faster by having them sort of meditate, close their eyes, go inside. And I found I was really expert at guiding people through their own inner world because it's sort of like I began to know the territory and how emotions worked. And so what I now call self-therapy, mm-hmm. and I believe the future of therapy is self-therapy, that we have all the information we need and feelings, even difficult emotions, are part of that. So it became this period of fascinating exploration to discover that people have their own best answers and I could help them find them. So then I put this all into some courses that I taught, and the subtitle is Emotional Therapy for Strength, Healing, and Guidance. And I wanted to call it Emotional Self-Therapy. But so the decision, again, a turning point to teach that. So I discovered my interests and my talents through all this, and put together the yoga teaching skills that I've been building but didn't really see a career in with helping people navigate, you know, solve their own problems. That's what I'm going to be doing for the next 20 years or however much time I have. And it's been delightful to see that emotions have been coming into the popular awareness as, I mean, I consider them the last frontier in self-awareness. We're still pretty remedial in our ability to work with and navigate our emotions. And yoga always talked about emotions as a sort of a problem as well. But what it was referring to was when emotions take over, and we know the brain science of this now, that
yes,
when emotions take over our rational mind, we sort of lose ourselves and we lose our mind and we do stupid things. But so my technique is to meditatively or mindfully help people stay awake and aware while they call up and deal with the emotion.
Okay.
And so it's almost like their conscious mind talks to their more primitive animal mind, and right, together they discover what they really need to do to be happier. So
yes, yes.
In short, if I can end it with the, you know, my mission is that, in short, that all humans know how to affect their own happiness.
Yes.
And specifically that when one doesn't feel good, that everyone on the planet has the ability to know what they're feeling, know why they're feeling it, know what to do about it, and then do that so they return to, you know, their own state of happiness. And
exactly.
So that's where we are today, Don.
No, it's beautiful. When did Goleman come out with Emotional Intelligence, speaking of emotions?
It's been a few years, and
was that 95? Was that 95? Was it that late?
It's on my shelf, but it's I don't recall. But it's okay. He's got a second version, and that's definitely part of the movement. What I love is that's a bestseller that has brought emotions into people's awareness. I find that it falls short in terms of helping people really know what to do with their feelings. But right, where my work is very experiential, very practical, and very results-oriented.
Well, you know the statistics about people in their life journeys and their career success and life success. It's dispiriting that people around the world, 80-some percent and even 75% in this country, are not in their sweet spot in their life and careers. They may be making a decent living. They may be effective. People have to survive, and they do what they have to do. They haven't framed the issues that allow them to be next to their best self, okay? Now, this is funny talking to you, who've been on your life journey since you were 8 years old, but it's coincidental. But what do you think that's about? What in our society keeps us away from knowing ourselves?
Fear and ambition. So there's a drive forward to survival type of drive to want and to have and to gain. And that's healthy. We have ambition and we want things, you know, seeing what other people have or doing what, wanting to be approved of or accepted or fit in or do what everybody else is doing has us move away from knowing ourselves and following our own guidance. Yeah. Fear of failure. So I'd say it's the positive of a drive and almost that's a positive thing that we want things and but we have a fear that I just mentioned. And then there's from day one, we're encouraged to fit in, and how are we going to please people and how are we going to earn love? And so we're actually trained away from following our own intuition. Mm-hmm. Our own feelings. Emotion is a form of intuition. So when yes, I feel, this doesn't feel right to me, or I'm unhappy in this job, or, oh boy, I really get excited when I think about doing such and such, but oh no, I could never do that. I guess I'd call it the battle between the head and the heart.
You know, beautiful.
The head says, be practical. And the heart says, but I want to fulfill myself and be happy.
Well, that's beautifully said. I think that's exactly right. I think it is the head and the heart. So what would you say to listeners around the world? And again, you teach courses on this, but in brief, just in brief, take a minute. What would you say to listeners around the world about how to combat this, how to get next to themselves, and whether they're ambitious and they're fear-based? They've got all those things going on. They're great conflicts. But how do they resolve those, or how do they start resolving those anyway? What would you say?
Well, my answer is my work, and that is
yes,
be in touch with how you feel about things. And that's not always easy or fun or comfortable. But, you know, every negative message, emotional message, has a positive intent behind it. So, for instance, with fear, oh, I could never do that. That's a protective feeling, an emotion that wants you to be safe. So it warns you. Like with me, it's like, well, if you want to be a coach, you better figure out how to get the money, you know, how to make it work and get enough clients and that kind of thing. So being in touch with oneself, we are a very head-based, intellectual-based, information-based culture. And
yes, we are.
We follow our head. And this is a basic teaching in yoga, that there's a way our mind is amazingly powerful and effective at figuring things out and logistics and taking care of us, solving problems. But life's bigger issues have to be felt from the heart. And I guess this is, again, where my yogic practice and teachings, you know, came together with this is like, I mean, everything we do in yoga is to close our eyes. We do lots of different things, meditations and postures to try to quiet the mind. And if you've ever done it, Don, when you find a little space where your mind has stopped its chatter, a whole nother world opens up where you listen to subtler clues. You listen to, you can actually know what you're feeling and why you're feeling it. You can listen to your heart and you can follow your heart. And then learning, I find that when I train people, I've got a 9-month training where I train people to do this. And, you know, there's a period where people can, first they got to learn to feel and they open it up. And then they're maybe scared of those feelings or they don't trust. Learning to trust that there's another voice inside you that is very trustworthy besides your thoughts. And by comparison, your thoughts are just sort of recordings of other things that have been said or that you've thought. So, yeah, I guess I'm saying learning to be mindful and meditate and feel. And then I guess this trust thing, I was going to say courage. As I was telling my story, there were moments that looked like courage. And that's why I said rebellion. I'm not sure they were courage. They were just, maybe they were anger, you know, like, hey, I don't care. I'm not doing what the man says, even if it means I might not, you know how I'm going to make a living. And whatever that motivation is, and, you know, sometimes pain is a good motivator to go ahead and take a risk.
So tell us, what have been the most palpable benefits of you from a very early age, an amazing early age, going on this journey of reflection and self-awareness and self-learning and self-teaching? What have been the most palpable benefits in your life?
If I trace back and think of the indecision, the doubts, the confusion, the wondering, the dissatisfaction, you know, to this day, I could have, you know, I'd be richer today if I stayed in college and gone that obvious route. But there was actually a moment when I was in pain and the moment when I decided I would leave, and then I thought it was temporary, but I never went back, was I said, what's the greatest thing I could achieve in a career of physics? And I thought of some discovery and, you know, maybe a Nobel Prize, and, you know, it might even help people a lot. But when I thought, if I got that and I was miserable, it wouldn't mean a thing. I selfishly want to be happy and this won't bring it to me. Mm-hmm. And moreover, I want to research something that brings other people happiness too, you know, that directly. And of course, I think I've discovered that.
One final question. What are you proudest of?
When somebody comes to me and they're in pain and they don't know why, what's happening, and they, you know, they want their problem solved. Sometimes it's immediate and sometimes it takes a good bit of time. But when both in the short term, when I see that person feeling better, when I see them realizing something that they're doing that's harming them, when I see their life getting better, when I see them getting happier, you know, marriages that were about to end and then they find their happiness again. So I guess when I can contribute to human happiness, that makes me the happiest.
Mm-hmm. Guru Amir Khalsa, what a great pleasure being with you today. We thank you for sharing the highlights of your rather remarkable life journey, courageous life journey. And I know that listeners around the world have learned lessons that will help them on theirs. So how do those listeners get in touch with you? What are the ways they can connect?
I'm at sensesofthesoul.com. And from there, I've got articles and some videos and some information. From there, you can talk to me, schedule an appointment to talk to me about private coaching. I've got there a full training program, a nine-month training, either a self-study or a live here in LA program that actually starts up in February. So my name, G-U-R-U-M-E-H-E-R at sensesofthesoul.com. I'm still a small business, myself and my assistant, and we send out books and we do these trainings. And so I'm very accessible, and I like to interact with people. And people can get on my newsletter, and every week I send different article about working with emotions. And often they contain, you know, little meditations to help people actually do this work. So I'm not just about information. I'm about experience.
Good. Excellent.
And I've got a YouTube channel. I think it's Senses of the Soul or Emotion, SOS. We abbreviate ourselves SOS.
Okay.
So, you know, I've got some Facebook activity, but my website's really my main hub, and okay, a lot of good videos on YouTube.
Oh, good. Excellent. Well, listeners know you can go to discovertalentpodcast.com and click on podcast. You can find this very fine interview with Guru Mehr. And the highlights of the interview as well as the links. So that's a direct connection to quickly get in touch with him. I want to thank our listeners across the world for joining us today. You can also subscribe for free on iTunes and Stitcher. We would love for you to be a part of our tribe and tell us how we can serve you better. In closing, every one of us is born with unique talents and gifts. We don't learn them. We cannot ignore them. They're just a part of who we are, our DNA. Whenever we discover them and use them in our lives and careers, we do not merely survive, we thrive in every way possible. So until next time, all my best, and whatever you do, have fun out there today.